Let's crack on. I know people
Oh.
will filter in as we get going. So, welcome to our latest 101 session. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm partnered with NPM Legal. We are a specialist employment law and business immigration practice. We're based in the south of England, but we work with clients that are all over the UK and, in fact, all over the world. But they have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. And that's where we come in and help them out. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Just a couple of housekeeping points. If you'd like to chat amongst yourselves during this webinar, you can just use the chat function down at the bottom. If you've got any questions for us, and we absolutely love questions, so we encourage them, do ask away. Use the Q&A button at the bottom because it just helps us to manage them when we get a load in. So Q&A for asking questions, please do fire away. We'll deal with them as we go along, or might save them to the end. Don't know, see how we feel today. But we will try and answer them all. If you are listening on Spotify or Amazon Music or any other funky music player, what we're talking about today is relevant as at the 4th of July, 2024. And obviously the law changes as time goes by, especially if we do get a different government today. So what we're talking about might all be irrelevant in 6 months' time. Who knows? I must also say, because we're going to be touching on some tax stuff today, neither of us are tax experts. We're not tax lawyers and we're not tax advisors. And I should say that just so our professional indemnity insurers don't have a heart attack if they're listening to this, but we're not going to be giving any tax advice as such. Obviously, we're talking about settlement agreements and there are tax elements in relation to that. So if you're ever concerned about tax treatment of stuff, then seek professional tax advice. And that's not going to be from us, but I'm sure we could introduce you to somebody very, very nice and helpful. Okay, so today we are talking about settlement agreements, severance agreements, termination agreements, that are kind of different terms used, compromise,
Separation agreements.
separation agreements, release agreements, opt-out agreements. In terms of legislation, we used to call them compromise agreements. They're now called settlement agreements, but they have different labels. How do you get the most out of these? How do they work? What about the discussions around them? So we're just going to talk a little bit about our collective experience of using them and some tips and tricks as well. Now, I'm sure that most of you who are joining today have worked with settlement agreements before, but just as a reminder, here are the key principles that we're talking about. There are a lot of laws that regulate their use. So you see reference to settlement agreements in the Employment Rights Act, in the Equality Act, and loads of other bits of legislation as well. The rules around them being binding are strict. So the agreements do have to be in writing, which is different to, say, a contract of employment, which doesn't need to be in writing. They must state expressly that the statutory requirements, the legal requirements for them, are actually satisfied. And the employee must take legal advice on what it means to enter into a settlement agreement. And that's really significant. Over the years, I'm sure you've seen this as well, Adrienne. I have seen individuals that have just gone off and signed a settlement agreement and kind of said, oh, I don't need to bother with getting legal advice, or can you pay me the legal advice contribution, please? Because I've done it myself. That's not going to be sufficient for it to be a valid waiver. So the employee does need to get independent legal advice on what it means to enter into a settlement agreement. And effectively, it's because you're waiving claims. So if you think about the whole purpose of settlement agreements, it's the employee waiving legal rights, statutory rights against the employer. And in exchange, there'll be some sort of benefit for the individual, right? So it might be an enhanced redundancy payment. It might be some form of payment they're not otherwise entitled to. It could even be some beneficial arrangement. So a decision to pay in lieu of notice when a company never ever does that. There could be other practical arrangements as well. But normally, there's some money changing hands. And the quid pro quo for that, to roll out some Latin, is the waiver of claims that the company benefits from.
And I think it's probably just worth pointing out that there are only two ways that statutory rights can be waived. And that bit you were saying about a settlement agreement, the employee says, oh, do I have to bother going to get legal advice? I actually had that a couple of weeks ago where the employee just sent it back signed and put a line through the advisor's certificate.
Brilliant.
And so there is a risk then. So just to be clear, if you as an employer decide that you're going to accept that and they haven't had legal advice, then their statutory statutory rights will not have been waived, and they can change their mind later and come back to you. But the other way to settle claims is through the conciliation service, ACAS. And I'm sure most of you will have at some point in your HR careers dealt with ACAS, probably alongside a tribunal claim. The ACAS form COT 3 is the other statutory form of settling claims. Now, this is something that that people don't often realise, is that you don't, if you wanted to settle via ACAS, you don't have to wait for the employee to go notify them under the early conciliation scheme. You can actually make an employer referral. So if ever you wanted to go down that route, it's open to you to contact ACAS. And if you go onto their website, there is a form or a notification form that you can complete to say that you want to make an employer referral. So that's the other way of doing it.
The bigger question, why you wouldn't always default to ACAS and use a COT 3 if the individual doesn't need to go and get independent legal advice?
I think it's because they're mega, mega busy, and sometimes it can take an awful lot longer.
Yeah, and also if you go into ACAS and they suggest their kind of template terms for a COT 3, they'll be about one side of A4.
Yeah.
And if you want a bells and whistles, all singing, all dancing settlement agreement, you're probably looking at 18, 19, 20 sides of A4.
We'll come on to a lot of that, won't we? We're talking about what you can use the agreement for. Mm. But also just talking about, the rights. And making an assessment of what rights an employee has. Remember, there's two sets of rights. So when we talk about statutory rights, we're talking about unfair dismissal, which is set out in the Employment Rights Act, things like discrimination claims, which is in the Equality Act, whistleblowing under the Employment Rights Act, and things like unlawful deduction from wages. So when we're talking about statutes, we're talking about those claims that are specifically written in the laws of the land. Then the second set of rights are the contractual rights. So things like bonus plans, commission plans, provision of benefits, all of those that would be set out in some form of contract, whether that's the contract of employment. And contractual rights can be waived in any form of written agreement. It's the statutory rights that can't. But when we're talking about settlement agreements, essentially in the sand, everything is waived that is a potential area of conflict. With the exception, there are a couple, aren't there, which can't be covered off in a settlement agreement.
Yeah, I mean, the main one are claims for breach of a collective consultation process. So under TULCRA, Trade Union Labour Relation Consolidation Act. So that's the bit of legislation that's dealing with collective consultation rights. So you might have encountered that if you've been dealing with a large scale redundancy exercise, so 20 or more people impacted. You might have dealt with those provisions if you've been dealing with types of transfers, associated changes and redundancies, large scale change of employment term exercises where you're potentially looking at fire and rehire or dismissal and re-engage, to use less inflammatory language. Those types of claims can't be waived, or some of those claims can't be waived using this settlement agreement process. Now, without kind of going down a legal rabbit hole, there is a workaround actually in terms of how you can protect the company in those circumstances by using indemnity clauses, warranty type clauses as well. So we can build in as much protection as possible that the law allows us to do, but fundamentally the starting point is you can't waive that type of claim. So you've got to think carefully if you're using settlement agreements in a large scale redundancy situation because you want to pay enhanced redundancy payments. You need to make sure that you are somehow capping off liability under that bit of legislation, right?
Yeah, but it also all depends on what kind of process you've run. So if you haven't run a collective process at all, the individuals can bring a claim. But if it's more a complaint about the way the process has been run and you've got employee reps in place, then it is more difficult. So it's super complicated. And I think we'll move on from that one right now, because otherwise we're just going to end up going down our own little...
Yeah, I would just say on that topic. Point, it is something to think about at the start of a change exercise, isn't it? Are you going to be using settlement agreements? And if so, at what point? And what do you want the agreements to say? So do factor that into that decision-making process. But yeah, you carry on.
Yeah, no, that's actually quite timely, because one of the things that that often comes up is, when's the best time to introduce an agreement? Mm. Because, we see it Well, I think I'd probably just categorize it as pretty much black and white. You either do it at the start of a dispute, or even when you see a possible dispute coming down the line, and or you do it once the dispute's up and running and flowing, and it can be at any particular time. But certainly in well, my preference, my personal preference, and that's because I most of my clients just want to be able to close matters down and move on, et cetera, not become embroiled in something that becomes very difficult and can often grow legs. So if you are prepared to settle, then it's very often at the start. So for example, an employee might raise a grievance. Now, call me cynical, and grievances are often, raised genuinely with a view to wanting to resolve matters so the employee can continue in employment. But where it comes on our desks, it's generally where the employee is probably looking at leaving, and a grievance can often be raised as leverage to negotiate an exit. And that might well be in the interests of you as the employer if that's something that you want to do. Because at the end of the day, you don't want a disgruntled employee in a role, right? Because that's difficult for everybody. So the sensible thing, if the employee is up for it, is to consider introducing a settlement agreement and a settlement at that particular point. Now, the upside of doing it from my perspective at the start is it's very often a point where the relationship has not gone completely to the dogs. In other words, the parties haven't become entrenched in their positions, which can often happen where, you run a difficult grievance process and the outcome may not be to the employee's liking. Then there's an appeal, then there could be various other bits and pieces that follow, like a data subject access request. And everybody becomes quite furious and quite angry and retreats to their corners, which does make settlement quite often more tricky. So that's at the start. Or it could be something that comes up later. So you might be in a position, for example, where you're doing a performance improvement process, and you want to start out by making sure that the employee is given the support that they need, that they are given that fair chance to improve. And it might be at some point down the line where things might head a bit sour and you think, this is not going in the right way. And the dispute comes up, and then you settle. And likewise, through the course of employment litigation as well. So, I mean, there's upsides to both, aren't there? I mean, what do you think, Peter? What do you see?
I mean, as you can imagine, we deal with so many issues, and we have so many grievances and tricky scenarios coming across our desks that both of us, we see all sorts of different approaches. And like you say, I think there's upsides and downsides to both, but ultimately it's a context specific decision. It's what right for you, it's what's right for your organization, or what's right for you as an individual. And we could probably spend another hour talking about what strategy you should adopt in those sorts of situations. And yeah, who knows, maybe a topic for a future webinar without giving all of our secrets away. We've had a question through, so let me just deal with this first. So it just touches on something that I mentioned at the start of the call about an employee who's been offered a settlement agreement, and he says he's happy with the offer and doesn't want to see a lawyer. What can I do apart from withholding money until he does? So thanks, Emma, for that question. I mean, I think if you're doing this to obtain a waiver of claims, so it's part protective in terms of the organization, and you're looking to get something back for money that you don't otherwise have to pay, you're just paying it because you want to be nice. Maybe it's an enhanced severance payment, enhanced redundancy, or the like. I think you just have to make it clear that a condition of receiving this amount is that a settlement agreement is entered into. And for the settlement agreement to be binding, it needs to have that independent legal advice component to it. So that's how I'd handle that. I'd just say, actually, if you're choosing not to see a lawyer and get advice on this agreement, then we're not going to be able to make this payment to you. So,
I think it's context. Can I just jump in there? So I think it's quite context specific. So, for example, if you're running a redundancy process and you want to offer the enhanced, I think it's quite easy to give that message, which is, sign the agreement, you get more. Don't sign the agreement with the legal advice that we require, and you're just going to get statutory. I would also say that, if the employee genuinely says they don't want to get advice, I think the first thing is just to explain to them why it's important that they do. In other words, you're going to give them an element of money so that they can go and pr be properly advised, because it is important that they understand what they're signing, and that's a requirement by law. The alternative is you do an assessment. It may well be that in actual fact it's something that it's not a statutory claim that's been asserted. So, you haven't paid me my commission is a typical example. It may be that you go, actually, we've done an assessment. You've been through your protected characteristics. None of those apply. You don't think it's an unfair dismissal. You don't think there are other claims. It may well be that you take that chance and accept that it's only going to be the contractual claims that are waived, and you're prepared to do it. We don't recommend that, because it's amazing how many people can then go and talk to their friends and go, oh, you had a claim for constructive dismissal, you should do this, you should do that. And then it's kind of too late. So, but an explanation to the employee, in our experience, generally often works. And as you say, to the person who asked the question, dangling the carrot of, well, we're not going to pay you unless you do it properly, very often makes people's minds focused.
Yeah, and that's a good point about the legal advice contribution as well, because it's customary. I'm sure those of you who are joining today who use settlement agreements will know customary for the employer to make a legal fee contribution towards the costs of getting that advice. So sometimes that will be enough for the employee to think, oh, actually, it's not going to cost me very much, or it's not going to cost me anything to get the advice that I need anyway.
Let's answer the one of the questions at the same time then, because one of the questions on that is it normal to pay for their legal advice? There's actually no legal requirement for you to pay for legal advice, but it has become over the otherwise is going to turn around and say, well, why should I go and incur the costs of my own advice when it's you who really wants me to sign the agreement? So it has become best practice. And in terms of amounts, well, I mean, that just depends. I did a settlement agreement and offered it to an individual who then went off to a super aggressive London law firm who rang us up and said, legal fees are 10 grand, and unless you pay them, it won't go ahead. And we were like, what? Because normally the standard is anywhere between sort of 350 to 500 quid for advice on a settlement agreement. But yes, no legal requirement, but it has become best practice.
Okay. In terms of claims that can be waived, then it is rare that an employee will try and bring a claim having signed a settlement agreement, but it does happen from time to time. And I
Yeah.
think, I don't know, I'd probably count on the fingers on one hand the number of times that I've seen it in terms of stuff that I've been involved in the last sort of 18, 20 years or so. But it does happen, and we all, as employment lawyers, read about the cases where it's happened as well. So it is really important to expressly call out what claims the employee says they have. I mean, it's a good process to go through anyway, just identify what do we see as the legal risk, because it just helps formulate what other stuff might need to be covered off in the settlement agreement itself. So some agreements we see will have a general waiver of everything. So there'll be a really long schedule appended to the agreement, and the main body of the agreement will just say all of these claims are waived, or all of these possible employment law claims will just be stuck into the agreement. Now, I think the downside with that is it's arguably just too broad, and question mark whether a male employee aged 60 is going to have a claim for maternity discrimination, and do you need to, put those in the main body of the agreement and that sort of stuff. So the approach that we tend to take is to try and be certain in terms of what the actual claims are. So an example of that would be in a redundancy situation, likely claims are going to be for unfair dismissal, unlawful deduction of wages, and payment of a statutory redundancy payment. So we'll probably, call out those main claims within the agreement. Now, where you might flex on that is if, for example, an employee has alluded to a sex discrimination issue in terms of redundancy selection. You might want to call out, or you probably ought to call out, claims for discrimination there as well. It doesn't stop you from including provisions that address other employment law claims more widely. So you might ask the employee to give what's effectively a legal promise that they don't have any other types of claim, which you can list out. I just wouldn't necessarily include those within the main body of a settlement agreement. Every law firm seems to take a different approach to that. There are kind of quite formulaic ways of approaching some elements of these agreements. So you see a lot of commonality as well. But every settlement agreement is different in its own way. And the approach we recommend, the approach we think is right from a legal risk perspective, is do identify what those specific claims are within the main body of the agreement. And I mean, it's just a transparent way of doing it as well, isn't it?
Yeah. fit for you as well, because you might pick up the phone to us as your lawyers and tell us the story, and we might think, there's potential there for disability discrimination. So if, for example, we ask a question, what did they disclose on any health questionnaire? If they disclose, for instance, that they're taking medication for depression, we might think, well, there is potential for disability discrimination, but do we want to expressly include it in the first draft of a settlement agreement, just in case we flag something to the employee who goes, why have they put that in there? I didn't even realize I might have a disability claim. And it then sort of gives them a bit of a tip that can then lead to higher negotiations. So what my approach in that situation is just to put in a placeholder. So you might say these are your express claims, and then leave a placeholder in which says employee's advisor to add in any additional claims, right? Because then it's up to them to say, right, we've had that discussion with our client. We also think that this claim should be included. And in that way, it hasn't come from you, the employer. So you're not tipping them off, if you like, but you are then ending up closing down express claims. Because you'll also see in most settlement agreements that the employee gives a promise that they've told their lawyer everything they need to know for the lawyer to advise them on what potential claims they have. So I'd just add that in.
What about entire agreements clauses? Because that's something that we get asked about.
Yeah, so I mean that's always an interesting one, and I had that last week where I was acting for an individual. So this individual came to me with this with the typical notice pay, holiday pay, re enhanced redundancy, but they also had a side letter giving them a retention bonus because they were staying in employment for a while to assist with a transition plan. Now that retention bonus was not in the main agreement. And it's really important to pull it in, because an entire agreement clause is the wording in the agreement, which basically says this agreement supersedes everything else. And if it's not in this agreement, it's everything that is required is in this agreement and this agreement alone. So worst case scenario, and I have to confess, I haven't had it happen, but an employer could turn around and refuse to pay any retention bonus once a settlement agreement signed on the basis that that has superseded any side letter. So that's what I'm looking out for when I'm advising individuals, just to make sure that everything that the employer is expecting to receive is included in that agreement.
And it might also explain that why you as HR practitioners may get requests from claimant side lawyers who are saying, can you amend the agreement to include this reference, please? And it's actually well be because there's an entire agreement clause in, the employee's been promised something by their manager, and they just want to make sure that it's reflected in this new contract that they're going to be signing. So it explains that. We've had a load more questions in, so I'm just going to talk a little bit about tax, and then we'll come on and just deal with a couple of the questions, I think. So tax, like I said at the head of the call, neither Adrian nor myself are tax advisors. So always get tax advice if you need it. Tax is a big one to get right in terms of settlement agreements, and it's a common misunderstanding that only redundancy payments qualify for the £30,000 tax-free exemption. It actually applies to all termination payments as long as they're genuinely termination payments. And, we'll use the term ex gratia, basically a payment that the individual doesn't have a contractual entitlement to. So they're not otherwise entitled to it. It's something that they're getting because you're being nice and offering them something over and above. You've got to be careful about relabeling some payments as termination payments. So, it's not uncommon for us to be asked, can we just pay some of the notice pay as a termination payment if they cut short their notice period? Can we just agree that their 3 month notice period should now be 1 month, and then we'll fold 2 months' money into the ex gratia payment? Can we agree that this bonus they're entitled to just gets lumped into the termination payment pot and no tax is paid on it? No to all of those things, basically. You can't do it. If you do it, then HMRC may well have a big problem with you. And if you're ever audited or they ever asked to look at settlement agreements, and I have had clients where that has happened, where HMRC have been sniffing around some other stuff and asked to see settlement agreements, they will want an understanding that things that should be taxed have been taxed appropriately. So you've got to be careful about relabeling stuff. Generally, I mean, holiday pay is going to be taxable as a contractual entitlement. Salary payments are going to be taxable in the usual way. Notice payments are going to be as well. Bonuses that employees are actually entitled to when they're paid out need to be treated as pay and so taxed appropriately as well. They'll all get taxed at source, so through payroll when the payments are made. Without getting sort of overcomplicating this, there are situations where you can structure a deal so it is more tax efficient. So a really common one is where you want to sign a settlement agreement now. Let's say the individual is going to leave in September, and then in September you pay out a payment in lieu of notice for 1 month's pay, because their notice entitlement is a month, and then you pay them a termination payment as well. A better way of structuring that could be that they work out their notice period between now and September, because there's time to run the clock down in terms of notice. So they carry on working. It's also labelled as their notice period. They're paying tax on that income. And then instead of paying a taxable payment in lieu of notice, you don't need to make a pile-on payment because they've already worked out their notice period. You could then fold that money into a termination payment. So there are ways to be more efficient in terms of how you're structuring stuff, and we have conversations around that all of the time. Let me just answer a couple of questions before we talk about confidentiality. Do all settlement conversations need to start with asking the employee if they're happy to have a without prejudice or protected conversation? It kind of depends. I mean, we'll come on and talk, I think, about protected conversations in a moment, actually. So no spoilers. But in most cases where you're making an offer of a settlement agreement, you probably want to label your offer at least subject to contract, so you're not creating a legal obligation to pay someone something without them having to go and sign up to a settlement agreement. And in most cases, there is going to be a without prejudice communication, depending on whether there's an underlying dispute, and you probably will have a protected conversation. But again, it's context specific. It doesn't always have to happen in such a rigid way, and it kind of depends on what the background scenario is for that, I think. And then I'll just take this other question as well. Can you clarify the differences with a settlement agreement when there is not a live dispute? I understand they're only covered for unfair dismissal protection versus all discrimination claims. So the situation, if I understand your question correctly, is the settlement agreement can be used to waive unfair dismissal claims and discrimination claims as well. It doesn't matter whether there's an underlying dispute or not. I mean, the issues around whether there's a dispute with an employee used to be relevant to whether there was proper without prejudice discussions going on, and whether discussions about resolving a dispute would be off the record or on the record. But in terms of using a settlement agreement, you're free to really introduce one at any time, I think. Well, if I misunderstood that question, Adrienne, what do you
Yeah,
think?
no, I think the question is right. So you can waive whatever you can get the employee to agree to waive under the settlement agreement. It's just about how you get to that point in terms of what label you give the conversation. And you are right in that protected conversations, in the sense of there is no live dispute. I know you said you were going to talk about it in a minute, but it might be more make more sense to give some examples now. So a live dispute might be, somebody is threatening to bring a claim, has brought a claim, etc., in which case the without prejudice label will protect any discussions that you have under that label, which means that they can't be relied upon in any formal process. The protected conversation is where there isn't that type of dispute. So for example, somebody raises a grievance, you haven't yet started looking at it, but you want to sit down with them and put an offer under their nose, or you might not want to go down the route of a performance improvement plan. So you might say, look, we're about to go into this, but before we do, we want to have a protected conversation. So it's a way of introducing the concept of reaching a deal for somebody to leave and settle claims. Label on it's section 111A of the Employment Rights Act. So it's a statutory conversation, but it will only give you the protection of conversations that could be used in an unfair dismissal claim. What it can't do is mask any discrimination claim conversations. So if you have a protected conversation and somebody uses what was being discussed in that conversation when it comes to the open process, for example, in the performance improvement plan, they might say, well, this plan is a complete sham because you've already had a conversation with me about me leaving, and therefore this is a load of rubbish. English. You can say in that situation, you're not allowed to talk about that right now because that was under the label of a protected conversation. But that protection doesn't apply to discrimination claims. And I think that's where sometimes the difficulty arises. And certainly from my perspective, those conversations still do happen, just people are mindful of that particular risk.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you just sort of be super measured in terms of what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, there's scope for satellite litigation around whether that conversation is admissible or not as evidence. Yeah. I mean, that's why Section 111A was brought in, because in the past, if there wasn't an underlying dispute, so in a PIP, performance improvement situation, the employee might be completely blissfully ignorant that there was any issue with their work, and the employer could be, you know, completely frustrated at this employee who wasn't working properly. The risk then in the old days of using a without prejudice discussion is that it's not without prejudice to anything. There's no dispute. So actually all the discussion with the employee was admissible as evidence, and employees were relying on them to bring a constructive unfair dismissal claim and say, hey, my employer's told me they want me to leave. That's a vote of no confidence. I'm going to bring a constructive dismissal claim. The government legislated to bring in this section 111A to give employers the mechanism of having a protected conversation. And by the way, employees can trigger them as well. They can go to their employer and say, you know, I'd quite like to leave. Can we have a protected conversation about it? And it's kind of like this safety bubble where you can have this discussion without being worried about being sued for constructive dismissal. But as Adrienne says, they can't be used as a veil for discrimination. And if you're trying to do that, then you're going to run into difficulties later on in terms of litigation.
Unless an agreement's signed.
Yeah. Just before we go to confidentiality, we take one more question and we'll pick up the others in a moment. Do you have to give time off in working hours for an employee to go and see a lawyer with their settlement agreement, or should it be organised in their own time? There's no rule around it, but obviously it's probably in your interest as an employer that the agreement gets signed. So why wouldn't you be accommodating and be reasonable in terms of letting somebody go and get the time? I mean, I normally encourage it. If someone's saying, I need 2 days off to go and arrange and see a lawyer, that's a little bit ridiculous. You know, they can phone up a law firm, make an online appointment, and you know that's not going to take very long to actually do. The time that's taken to get the advice, I think just let them do it in work time. It isn't going to be a particularly long appointment, or it shouldn't be. But just be reasonable, because ultimately it's in your interest that the agreement gets signed. Otherwise, you wouldn't be offering an agreement in the first place. Confidentiality.
Right. Let's look about this, because there most agreements will deal with a number of different confidentiality pieces. The first is the same as should be in your contracts of employment, in that you will get them to agree that any of your confidential information remains protected. That is important because of what we talked about before with the entire agreement clause. So you're reminding them of their obligations of that. But then you're talking about things like not bad mouthing the employer, which of course can be included. You know, you shall not make derogatory statements, you won't publish anything, etc., etc. But there are important exceptions, and it's really come about as a result of the Me Too movement that these gagging clauses were very carefully looked at. You know, you will have watched the news, not just in the US, but also here, where it seemed the whole world was pretty unhappy with the fact that wrongdoing can be hushed up with money, and the use of these NDAs, which have been massively criticised. Now, NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, also include settlement agreements, right? Because we have these confidentiality provisions in there. And this is specifically in relation to discrimination, whistleblowing claims that are being settled, because people are really unhappy that this stuff is being hushed up. You know, there may be arguments alongside of, well, if money's being paid, then that's fair enough, but we'll set that one aside. That's a different topic. But it's now really important to make sure that your confidentiality clauses will expressly carve out that nothing will prevent either party from raising criminal wrongdoing, speaking to the taxman, reporting stuff to the police, and making a protected disclosure under whistleblowing legislation. And in actual fact, our profession, solicitors' profession, legal profession, has also been given some fairly stringent guidance that we have to make sure that when we're advising and when we're drafting these types of agreements, that these carve-outs are actually included. So that's why now you're probably seeing a whole list of things which say nothing in this agreement can prevent you from saying X, Y, and Z, which, you know, can be tricky, particularly if you're settling things like discrimination or whistleblowing claims. We accept that, but just so you know, our hands are tied, and to a certain extent, as HR professionals, so are yours as well. But yeah, you're just kind of relying really on the fact that both parties have reached a position where they're happy, but you're also then obviously got a bunch of warranties in the agreement that they're not going to bring any other claims.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We talked about protected conversations a few moments ago. ACAS best practice is that you should allow 10 days for an employee to go and take advice on a settlement agreement before you then decide what the next steps is. In my experience, employees will quite often come back within that 10-day window. Sometimes they drop off the radar completely, and then you're having to chase to find out what on earth's going on. Just another quick point on protected conversations. For the conversation to be a class as a protected one, you do actually have to make an offer. So a discussion about concepts around, you know, conceptually, do you like the idea of leaving us if we were to strike some sort of deal, probably isn't going to be sufficient to actually give you the legal protection for that conversation. So you have to make an offer. Normally, I recommend you go in with a draft settlement agreement, hand it over or email it after the discussion. And then best practice is 10 days. The reason why it's 10 days is so the employee can't argue that they've been effectively harangued into rushing something through. But as I say, in our experience, quite often the employee will come back a lot sooner than that 10-day window. I don't think we need to say too much, Adrienne, just about the kind of negotiation strategy, but just offers generally, what do you think about that in terms of where to start?
Well, I mean, personally, I always like to have a start, you know, I would like to have a legal hook on how you start the conversation. So I'll take performance as a typical example. So we all know going through a performance improvement process can be difficult. So you might say, right, we've got performance concerns, could put you on a plan. You need to think about how long your plan might last, because that can then in turn drive what would be an appropriate offer. So typically we would say performance improvement plan would last 3 months, because you go, here's the plan, review period of a month, first warning, second review period, second warning. And then after the third month, you'd probably be looking to terminate if they haven't improved. So you might then say to them, look, you can go through this plan if you want, or we'll pay you the 3 months on top that it would take if we went through the plan, because we have concerns about whether you'd be successful. So it's making sure that you're matching that legal hook to what you're prepared to offer. And I know the instinct is to pay less, but you've just got to make sure that your offer makes sense. I think that puts you in the best position to negotiate. You can obviously flex it a little bit if you wanted to go in a little bit less. So, for example, you might be prepared to pay 3 months gross pay in lieu of a performance improvement plan. So you might say, well, the offer could be 3 months net pay, because I think that then makes sense. That gives you then somewhere to go, because we all know that negotiations on agreement are very rarely, here's the offer, take it, unless you are so strong on your case and you're prepared to go through the process that it is a take it or leave it offer. So that's kind of the way that my mind would work on that.
Yeah. Okay. I would say don't forget about the practical issues as well, because the settlement agreement is an opportunity to wrap in any practical aspects around departure. So common stuff will be company property. Are you going to let the individual retain any property? You know, it's not uncommon for people to take mobile phones, laptops. Now we're all working from home from time to time, desks, you know, other equipment that's been purchased. Don't forget about the tax position on that, though. It can be a tax benefit in terms of letting people retain equipment and ownership of it. So all that stuff should be addressed within the settlement agreement. If someone's keeping a laptop, what's happening with any company licensed software on it? How are you going to get all of the company data off it? That sort of stuff. Mobile phone. Are they going to be able to keep their number as well? If so, do they need to get a PAC code? Who's going to get that? Who's going to be responsible for the contract transfer?
Just on that point, just jumping in. Mm. If they're a key member of your sales, don't let them keep their mobile phone number. Just saying.
Yeah, I mean it's one we see quite a bit, isn't it? Announcements. Does there need to be an announcement made? If so, is it going to be an internal announcement? Is it going to be an external announcement if they've got some visibility within your industry? You can agree the announcement wording, the form of the announcement, when it's going to be released, who it's going to be released to. All can be covered off very easily within the settlement agreement. Just a couple of quick points at the end as well, and then we'll do the last couple of questions we've got. Their advisor, just check that it is someone who can lawfully sign the agreement. Believe it or not, I've had several cases where lawyers have signed who are no longer on the role of solicitors, so they're not insured to advise on these. I've had in-house lawyers sign them because they're doing a favor for a mate, and equally, they're not insured to advise on the agreement. And the significant, you might say, well, so what? The significance of that for you is that if the waiver of claims that are given are not valid, then it opens the door for the individual to sue you after all. So do check that the individual is capable of signing, and we can help with that if necessary. Some trade union reps are able to sign, and legal executives can sign settlement agreements as well. And in terms of signatures, nowadays we get agreements signed electronically. There might be some technicalities around if you're having an agreement signed as a deed, but basically we get the lawyer to sign the agreement using DocuSign. Our client will sign via DocuSign, the individual will sign via DocuSign. As well, so that is all possible. Couple of last questions, Adrienne.
First one's certainly one we've had before. What do you recommend in the situation where the firm the employee goes to is a very expensive firm and they quote much more than you're willing to pay? Anything other than advising that they can make up the difference or find another reasonably priced advisor? I've had exactly this, and it is hugely frustrating. And there is no simple answer, except that that legal hook that I was talking about before needs to be really strong, so that there needs to be a threat, which is, will be reasonable, Mr. Employee, or if you like, if we're not going to be able to reach agreement on this, that's fine. On Monday, you can come to an informal meeting. We have a plan that we want to discuss with you. So you've got to be prepared to go through the formal process as the encouragement, shall we say, to act reasonably on the agreement. And otherwise, there's not an awful lot that you can do.
I'd agree with that. I think be reasonable as well, though. 350 plus VAT as an advisor contribution seems to have been in place for about 15 years and not really kept pace with, reality, I guess. So just be aware in terms of whether you're being reasonable with your own contribution, fit for the circumstances. Some agreements are really straightforward and easy to kind of work through, but not every agreement is the same, and some are really long, some are really complex. They have complex situations behind them as well. So do bear that in mind as well in terms of your own expectations. The last question was just a comment in relation to that previous question, and clarify what's the difference between settlement agreements and without prejudice communications. So thanks to everybody that asked questions. That's absolutely fantastic. As a reminder, you can get all of our back recordings on our website, NPM Legal. You can listen to our podcast on Spotify and Amazon Music and Apple as well if you just search for Employment Law 101. So thanks so much for joining today. We're back in a couple of weeks' time. We're going to be looking at, and I set this question before we have a general election date, but are probationary periods still relevant? And after today, depending on the outcome, I can tell you now the answer to that is probably going to be a resounding yes. All of a sudden, they are super relevant again. This ties in with Labour's plans for day one unfair dismissal rights. So if you're interested in finding out more about that and why probation periods suddenly will become very much in vogue again, join us 2 weeks' time, same time, 11 a.m. In the meantime, please do email us with any feedback. But otherwise, enjoy the rest of your week and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. So thank you.